Hello and welcome to the third in our Pursuing Better Together podcast series produced by Arch Insurance International. In this series of conversations, we talk about what it means to pursue better, how to commit to continual improvement, the importance of collaboration, and how to ensure you are always setting the bar that little bit higher, speaking to leaders and change makers from both inside and outside the insurance industry. In this condensed version of our conversation with Daniel Stander, we consider the importance of cross-sector collaboration in closing the protection gap, explore the challenges of bringing the public and private sectors together for a greater climate good, and discuss how the fundamental concepts of pursuing better together are central to creating an environment in which constructive dialogue can take place. Daniel is an influential figure at the interface between public policy and the private sector. He is perhaps best known in his capacity as Special Advisor to the United Nations, and in particular for his work with the United Nations Development Programme, the UN agency which leads the United Nations in-country work addressing issues of poverty, inequality and climate risk around the world. He is also Deputy Chair of the Resilient Cities Network, the world's largest city-led resilience network, where he works with 100 mayors in 40 countries across every continent to help ensure cities stay strong, even when things go wrong. And if that wasn't enough, Daniel is also a non-resident senior fellow at the Atlantic Council, where he is currently focusing innovative ways to combat the threat of extreme heat. Daniel, first of all, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, Daniel, the focus of today's Pursuing Better Together talk is on industry and governmental bodies and how they can work more closely together to help reduce the impact of climate change on more vulnerable communities. Just given the description that I've just given there and the various positions that you hold at the UN and of course, elsewhere, these positions, I suppose, must place you right at the centre of this climate-focused discussion. Is that fair?
Well, that's kind of you to say. I'm not quite sure I'm at the very centre of everything, Nigel, but I am fortunate enough to inhabit a unique space at the intersection of many of the most important debates and, importantly, the most important solutions around how we deliver an equitable response to climate risks and do so in a way that is both sustainable and leaves nobody behind. So I guess, yes, I'm in a very privileged position there.
Perhaps an unfair question to put to you, Daniel, but I want to get a sense, given where you sit, of what you see as the fundamental challenges we face in trying to close what is a widening protection gap and starting to elevate climate resilience to a level that is actually sufficient given the scale of the problem we currently face.
Now, you say it's an unfair question. All questions are fair. It's a really difficult question to answer. Mm. I have some mental models in terms of how I approach questions like that. I think we need to, on one axis, be thinking mm. about the micro to the macro. On another axis, we need to be thinking about the, if you like, the business and the personal, or if you will, the livelihoods and the lives. And I think in a different dimension, we need to be thinking about what I would describe as the policy versus the programmatic. And right. we need to be majoring on all of them. To focus only on business is to miss something very important, meaning even when businesses are economically hit, those hits have real impacts on real people and their ability to fulfill their human potential. Mm. There's also a really complex set of interdependencies. So an extreme weather event can have a significant ripple effect in places far away. And I'm not just talking about value chains and supply chains, although that's also super important. We saw that in Tohoku. We saw that in the Thai floods, which halted or negatively impacted production in Western Europe and America. But I'm actually even more interested in the forced displacement of people, which yes. of course is a big impact for the individuals themselves and the families left behind, but it's also an impact for their host communities. So thinking about ways in which we can address the totality of these impacts is going to be very important. I also want to mention nature, because I haven't up until now. There are biodiversity risks at play here, but there's also an opportunity for us to work with nature and use nature to put in place what gets described as nature positive solutions, which will at the same time help us both with the mitigation in the climate change greenhouse gases sense of the word for carbon capture, but will also help us in the risk reduction by providing natural barriers to, for example, things like storm surge. Mm. So I guess I fall back on the sustainable development goals. And of course, there are 17, and the first 16 are very issues driven, whether that be to end poverty, to end hunger, to empower females, to embrace climate action, to think about life on land or life below water. We worked hard to develop those goals. But actually, it's the 17th one, which is probably closest to my heart, because the 17th goal is called Partnerships for the Goals, or at least that's my shorthand for it. And I argued hard amongst others, especially in the private sector, for its inclusion, because the size of the challenge is so great that no constituency, public or private, can alone address these issues. And it's only through partnership across all of these dimensions, macro down to micro, business down to personal, policy down to programmatic. It's only through deep, deep collaboration that we can have any chance of closing the gap, as you describe it, to addressing the climate crisis. And importantly, doing so in a way that drives equity, especially for the most vulnerable.
I just wanted you to focus in a little bit on this idea of the importance of cross-sector collaboration in achieving the range of solutions that the climate challenge requires. Just how important is that, and how do you go about facilitating that?
Yeah, so there's an abstract answer to that question about how does one do collaboration? But as a way into that, maybe before I get into that more abstract conversation, maybe I can just explain a little about how I segment the different kinds of solutions. So I've spent my career at the interface between resilience and innovation. And that innovation has tended to take three forms: scientific innovation, technological innovation, and financial product innovation. And as I said, what I'm always looking for is a way of capturing new science and new understanding about the phenomena, finding technologies that help us better understand, measure the world and adapt to it, and then often wrapping those new findings, those new scientific and technological innovations, into financial product innovation that will allow us as a society to offer a safety net to those that are most exposed. So that's the framework that I use to think about the different types of solutions. And then there's a question, which is how, against that backdrop, do you bring the constituents required to the table? And that's not easy to answer, because fundamentally the public sector and the private sector, at least in my experience, are not the most obvious of bedfellows. They don't actually, at least historically, tend to speak the same language. What I came to realize is that it wasn't easy for the public sector to dock into the private sector. You can't expect governments to spend all of their time having conversations with every single stakeholder. It's just not feasible. So trying to create fora where the public sector can more easily interact, dialogue with, and if necessary, contract with the private sector, but also finding fora in which the private sector can, with a single voice, talk to the public sector in a way that's coherent, in a way that's not competitive, in a way that lays down the competitive dynamics, where they can come together for something that transcends those competitive dynamics. That I felt was missing. And so it was really important to try and create those fora. Once you have those fora, then we can begin to learn each other's languages. Then we can begin to find common ground. Then we can begin to find where there is alignment to better understand respective motivations, and then hopefully come together in ways that are not just good for both parties, meaning public and private, but good for the wider societal outcomes that we're trying to achieve. And that for me is the key, creating not just talking shops where people actually can talk past one another, but creating spaces where real work can get done.
Are you seeing a greater recognition on the part of the insurance industry of the role that it needs to play in enhancing climate resilience? And are you seeing it being a more proactive entity in these four that you're talking about?
No, the short answer is yes. A slightly longer answer is it's about time. One of my particular bugbears, maybe even a hobby horse over the years, is that the insurance industry has not done a very good job of communicating its societal value. What we tend to hear, put yourself in Monte Carlo, where, you know, it seems like every other year when we are there, there's a storm in the water, right? And the CEOs of the insurers and the reinsurers are being asked by the media, what's the size of this loss? How big is it going to be? Is it going to change pricing? And the standard answer from the CEOs quite correctly is now is not the time to talk about the size of the loss to the market. Now is not the time to talk about rates hardening. Now is the time to be there for our customers and pay claims. That's absolutely right. And you could argue that's the core value proposition of risk capital, to be there to pay the claims, to make good on its promises. But to talk about that alone is actually to greatly undersell the value of the insurance industry. In fact, I'll go one step further. I don't describe insurance, or I prefer not to describe insurance as an industry. I don't see it as a sector of the economy. I see it as part of the fabric of society. Fundamentally, insurance underpins how societies work and how business gets done. So I think it's a super important institution of society, and I would like to see us do an even better job of expressing and communicating and maybe even quantifying that societal value, which is far greater than the total sum of claims paid. When I think about insurance solutions, I don't just think about take some risk capital and deploy it against risk in the form of insurance policy. I think about an insurance solution which comes from a methodology, a way of thinking about risk, a way of quantifying impact, a way of understanding volatility of loss and smoothing that, and then thinking innovatively about solutions that can address it, whether that be putting a strategy in place, whether that be putting the analytics in place to understand the risk, whether that be putting in place the mitigative measures that reduce the risk by doing things differently, and whether that be by transferring the risk or financing the risk on someone else's balance sheet, and finally, whether that be understanding how to respond and recover and proactively in a way that prevents losses from escalating. The insurance industry knows better than anybody else how to do all of these things, but we don't really talk about it that much. And your question was, is the insurance industry doing a better job of fulfilling its societal value? The answer to that question is yes. I think it's been a long journey. I think there's lots more to do, and I'm encouraged by what I've seen. I'd like to see it do more.
Coming back to this idea of collaboration, what are you seeing in terms of the environments that are being created that are conducive to this collaborative approach and this forward momentum, particularly given the number of parties that we are talking about just given the scale of the challenge?
There is no collaboration without trust, Nigel. And one of the things I like about the phrasing of this particular podcast series is it puts at its center the fact that we can pursue better together. All three of those things are important. The relentless pursuit, we must aim high. I love the Japanese word kaizen, which is essentially the pursuit of continuous improvement. And that it is better, that we deserve better, we demand better, but that we won't get anywhere by ourselves. And I'm a big fan of indigenous wisdom, because there's something about the wisdom, knowing that it's maybe 3,000 years old, that somehow gives it greater weight and helps you believe it. But there's that old saying that if you want to go fast, go alone. If you want to go far, go together. Now, the question then is, what helps us go far together? It's that vulnerability and the ability to express vulnerability, which I think is the basis of trust. So you need that ability to feel comfortable. I think it all starts from self. And it starts from our ability to feel comfortable with our own vulnerabilities, our ability to be secure in who we are, sufficiently secure that we can then step into places that may be a little bit unsafe and venture some vulnerability to see where the trust comes back. And that for me is fundamentally the basis of collaboration. Without trust, there is no collaboration. Without vulnerability, there is no trust. And without this inner security, there's no space to venture the vulnerable. And once we're comfortable with ourselves, then we can lean in and go further together.